you lie awake and ponder ponds of microscopic life? Expose yourself to exoplanets high up in the night? Are you crazed for kinematics? Do you fantasize of fauna? Everybody's got a question, luckily we're gonna unpack the stack of facts that you think back to every day. Attack your ignorance, you'll be unmatched in every way. Sit down and lend an ear, all the answers will be clear. I'm running out of rhymes, I'll let the host take it from here.
Hey, Ellie. You know, I feel like we talk a lot about different like components of nature, and I want to focus on, you know, one we don't talk about enough, but one I know you have a very soft spot in your heart for, and that's fire. And I'm just curious if you have any fun fire stories for us today.
Well, if the research for this episode didn't get me put on a watch list, that comment will. So I think my favorite fire story is when I was still in science theater in my undergrad, and we were doing press for our Halloween show. And Isaac, guest of the podcast, and I went on the 6 a.m. local news for a 3-minute guest spot. So we had 3 minutes to do a science demo and talk about the Halloween show. And we don't have a lot of 3-minute demos. Usually they're 5 to 10 minutes. And so we decided to bring a self-combustion reaction. So we brought a bowl of nitroglycerin and another chemical that I'm now forgetting.
Just like a literal bowl, like yeah, a plastic
a bowl with a glass bowl.
It's gotta be glass.
And then a cork on the bottom so that when the glass got hot, it wouldn't like scorch the news table. And you mix some chemicals together. And when you do that, they have a self-exothermic reaction. So the reaction creates heat and heat speeds up the reaction until it lights on fire. But that takes about 2 minutes. So you have like time to talk while the bowl's just sitting there. And then it starts to smoke and then it just goes and lights on fire. So it's perfect for like a 3-minute news spot.
So do you have it down enough where it's like, here's the pitch, here's the event, like two minutes, and then segue into boom, here's explosion?
Yes. So I was talking about, I was like, hey, this is the reaction. And Isaac was adding the stuff. And then we were like, this is the Halloween show. And we were talking with the host who had safety glasses on and everything.
The full nine yards.
The news anchor wear PPE. Because we were like, this bowl's going to light on fire. Here you go. You have a lot of hairspray. Maybe sit over here. And
you guys use your eyes a lot for your job. So I'm going to protect this.
Yes. Yeah. And we had like a safety conversation, like with the news anchor. We checked in with the station to make sure we weren't like right next to a fire alarm, like for our safety. And then we lit a fire on the local news, and that is totally still on the internet. You can find that video.
Well, there you go. For all the deep, you know, everyday dissection podcast lore people, there's another one for the archives out there. Find that YouTube.
Yeah, I think I was in the local news in like 20, it was like 2018.
You're giving them too much information. You don't make it easy for them. you gotta search for it.
I didn't tell them which news station.
All right. So why are we talking about fire today? What is getting you put on a government watch list?
Well, this is our season finale, so I thought it was best to go out with a bang. Ha! And now I've made that joke and we're done making it. I just wanted to get it out of the way. Because otherwise I was going to be almost making it the whole time we were talking.
That's a promise you can make.
Okay. Well, you can make that joke 2 more times because rule of three.
All right.
If you make it a 4th time, I'm calling you out for breaking the rules of improv. All right.
That's fair.
Yeah. And so we're going to talk about the history of explosives today. So we're going to talk a little bit about how the chemistry of explosives have evolved and some stories that go with that.
Stories. Some light, fun stories.
They're not light. They're not really fun, but they're an important part of history. And I think that it's very important to talk about the human impact of explosives, which is it's innumerable. And so I've picked a few things that I think I wanted to talk about, but I want to add the caveat that there's a lot of things that we're not going to talk about that we probably should, just because the list is so long. I couldn't even find, there would be no way for me to find the whole list, let alone talk about it in a single episode. And that's the caveat I want to put on the history that I'm adding to this, the science episode.
Spoiler alert, science has been used in some bad ways by some bad people constantly. And this is just our Cliff Notes version of this specific version. So,
because we are a science podcast, but science doesn't exist in a vacuum. And I think it's important to talk about what was around that science.
We talk politics in damn near every episode. So like if they get mad at us at this point, you should have known. I don't know. If you're a new listener, welcome. If you're an old listener, you should have known. Like, I don't know else to say it. I feel like we've been clear.
We try our best to put science into context. That's where we want to sit. So I feel comfortable making this call. I just wanted to add the caveat of an incomplete history.
Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to make sure everybody knew this will be a fun one. This is great. This is one of the good ones you look forward to.
I want to start with the fact that as a group, and by group, I mean humanity, we've had fire for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
You
almost might say we needed it to survive.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of our longest running obsessions as a group is making fire bigger and hotter. And fire's cool. Like I like learning about combustion reactions. They're really interesting. But they have quite the dark side. And so fire can be a very, very good thing. We need it to survive. But also on the other hand, fire can be a very, very bad thing.
It can be used to kill things.
Yeah, we're going to get into that. And so eventually our obsession with making fire more effective graduated to explosives with the invention of gunpowder in China in the 10th century. So initially that was used for things like fireworks. But of course, fireworks are very close to other things. And so the graduation from fireworks to warfare was pretty quick.
Are you trying not to say the G word? It feels like you're trying very hard not to use the G word, even though we all know what you're talking about, the G word.
What's the G word?
The guns.
Oh, yeah. Guns are fine. I don't have a date for when guns were invented, so that's why.
Okay, so you don't want to be we're just talking cannons and stuff now. We haven't gotten into muskets and rifles and...
Yeah, and also gunpowder is used in plenty other weaponry that's not a gun. Mm-hmm. So I feel like limiting ourselves to just guns... considering I'm not actually planning on talking about guns at all.
I guess that's fair. That's fair. So I guess cannons are probably even the more specific thing we should be focusing on in terms of the evolution of what's to come.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's happening here is we're talking about gunpowder, which is made of three things, potassium nitrate, sulfur, and charcoal. So potassium nitrate is an oxidizer. So it creates, when it reacts, creates oxygen. Sulfur is a stabilizer and charcoal is our fuel. So when you add heat, when you light gunpowder, it creates a multi-part combustion reaction. So the sulfur ignites first, which then ignites the charcoal. So now both of those things are on fire. Mm-hmm. And when the heat is sufficient, the potassium nitrate splits into nitrogen. So just two nitrogen molecules put together, N2, that's what's in our atmosphere, and oxygen, O2, also in our atmosphere. And potassium sulfate, which is two potassium molecules and a sulfur. So there you go. And then the oxygen then reacts with the charcoal, which is carbon, to make carbon dioxide. So you can see there's several steps here. So what you end up with is nitrogen, carbon dioxide, and potassium sulfate coming out of this reaction.
And all of that together makes boom.
All of that together makes boom. And it's because there's oxygen being actively added to the reaction when the potassium nitrate splits, that allows for a much faster combustion rate compared to something like a campfire, which is only using the amount of oxygen that's in the air around it.
Right. All those chemicals mixing together in this specific formula allows for stuff that can kind of coexist naturally together to go through these chain events until bang, boom.
So the bang boom, there's another component, because right now we just have fire really fast.
Okay, fire really fast.
And we're at fire really fast. And so the explosiveness has to do with the speed of the reaction combined with putting the gunpowder into an enclosed space.
Right. Okay. So the cap going off, or like the lock on the pistol hitting.
Yes, we are not to caps yet. We are going to get to them, though, I promise. So this is just packed gunpowder. So we're at the point where it's like, think about like the Revolutionary War, that Revolutionary War cartoon that we all watched in school.
You got the muzzle, you shove it down in there. You've got the cannon, same thing. You got to use the giant like plunger to push everything in with the gunpowder.
Yeah. Oh, the show's Liberty Kids. That's what I'm thinking of. Did you watch?
I didn't even realize you were thinking of a specific show.
I was just picturing fifth grade history class. We watched Liberty Kids, and it's this cartoon about teenagers in the Revolutionary War.
It's now occurring to me what like specific propaganda that show was. On PBS too. Goddamn. Like, wow. It wasn't even a bad show, but like, Ben Franklin was their mentor figure. Like,
yes. Wow. And they worked at a printing shop. And they were rebels with the American Revolutionary Army. Sure. They meet Molly Pitcher. That's the episode I'm thinking of, because she's the woman where like her husband gets shot and she fires the cannon. She was like a nurse.
Oh yeah, then, I do remember that episode. Yeah.
I dressed up as her in fifth grade for Historical Figure Day.
You know, we all have our regrets. We all live with things, I guess. Haunting images of our past that time where you're like, whoops.
Yeah. I mean, when you're nine in fifth grade history class, there's a lack of like women with cannons and swords in class. So I think we were all like, lady with a cannon, thank goodness. And we were
exactly about it. Like they weren't teaching you about Joan of Arc in American history. And so it was you're really limited between like flag sewing lady or cannon lady.
Those are literally all that's, and otherwise they're like, and then there were no other women. I think some of the founding fathers were maybe married, but we don't talk about them. And
a lot of them were cheating on their wives. We definitely don't talk about that.
Do not talk about that. But those are the two. We get Betsy Ross and Molly Pitcher, and I was Catholic, so I learned about Joan of Arc pretty young. She's always been my favorite.
Speaking of fire.
Yes. No. Again, another example of bad fire.
Bad fire.
Back to gunpowder. So the heat from the reaction causes our gases in an enclosed space. So if you've packed your gunpowder into a musket, say, the heat from the reaction causes all of the gases in that enclosed space to expand very rapidly, which provides propulsion.
Right. And so that sends the bullet or the cannon flying forward to your enemies, probably missing them because at this time you couldn't aim for shit.
Yeah. You were just kind of blasting stuff in a general direction.
The way our founding fathers intended.
Yes, that was, I want to keep that in mind. In the 1700s, this was where we were at.
Yes.
Important to remember. For no political reason whatsoever.
Just dropping that one in there.
Yeah. And I think it's also important to note that gunpowder does need to be like made correctly and in the right ratio of ingredients in order for the mixture to ignite and explode. This ratio has been adjusted over time. Mm-hmm. But the current ratio used to make modern gunpowder was developed in the 18th century. And we've kind of kept that ever since. It's 75% nitrate, 10% charcoal, 10% sulfur.
So that right there is what's going to get you on the watch list.
It is on every single website about gunpowder.
Okay, well, then.
Otherwise, it wouldn't be in here. If I didn't find it like 10 times while I was searching, it's not hard to find.
Okay, well, then.
That's on government websites. So if that's what gets me put on a watch list, there was a .gov website that had that on there.
I mean, yeah, it's a trap, Ellie. They're trying to find you.
Like I said, I did a lot of Googling for this one. This one's going to get, if I wasn't already on a watch list of some kind for other research I've done for this podcast, this is probably.
Have we checked our listenership in DC? I want to do a before and after on this episode and maybe like a few other choice episodes.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you can, we have analytics, daily analytics.
So. You know, that's for private. We don't need the CIA to actually hear our analytics data. They can find that out on their own time. I know they can.
Yeah, they definitely can.
They're probably keeping track of that better than we are.
Oh, for sure. And so we've had gunpowder for a long time at this point. So now we're getting up to 1846. And that is when nitroglycerin was invented. You may remember that from the Looney Tunes cartoon when I think Daffy Duck creates a bomb inside himself.
Yeah.
In one of the episodes by drinking nitroglycerin.
I think Elmer Fudd does it to him, maybe. I might be wrong on that, but I like it's, yeah, like definitely the the bomb goes in and then it's, yeah.
Yeah, no, he drinks the nitroglycerin.
Oh, yeah. No. Oh, I do know, remember that episode. Yeah.
Gunpowder, and then he's like, shake well, and jumps up and down. It's like when he and Bugs Bunny are like trying to outperform each other.
Yes.
Yeah. If anyone's a big Looney Tunes fan, you will remember this episode. And I apologize for our listeners who are not Looney Tunes fans and have no idea what we're talking about.
Do Gen Z fuck with the Looney Tunes? Have we figured that one out yet?
I have no idea. We had a DVD set of Looney Tunes. So I
like watched school, like the classic tunes.
I've watched like exclusively those Looney Tunes. It's mostly Tweety Bird and Bugs Bunny. Yeah. And then my dad really liked one episode of Looney Tunes with Foghorn Leghorn. We watched that on YouTube.
Okay. Look, I like Foghorn Leghorn. It's the fact that it's one episode.
I've seen one episode of Foghorn Leghorn, and it was because my dad made a reference to it. None of us laughed. And he was like,
you kids need to appreciate it. Damn it, kids.
He's like, now I have to educate my children.
And all right.
Up on YouTube. Is that one? And then we didn't have the rabbit season, duck season episode. That was also looked up on YouTube.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's you need to see rabbit season, duck season. That's the episode.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was not on the box set. So we did have to specially look that one up on YouTube.
I think the unfortunate truth is a good portion of Americans' understanding of explosives, like as a child, probably came from Looney Tunes cartoons. And so I'm just curious if that is true for the younger generations as well, or have because Boomerang is no longer a thing. Is that a lost art and a lost medium that people just, I mean, I guess they've had revivals. This isn't important, but I'm just
Boomerang.
You don't know Boomerang? Oh man, Ellie. Oh no, it was a subsection of Cartoon Network. It either came on earlier or it was a different channel, but it only ran like old, like the Hanna-Barbera stuff, like the old, like Scooby-Doo was on all the time. The Scooby-Doo knockoff with the shark was on all the time.
What?
Have you not seen? Look, there's a period, we're so off topic, but there's an episode of Scooby-Doo that makes fun of the fact that Hanna-Barbera basically kept trying to copy the teens with weird pet formula.
Scooby-Doo was a shark?
No, it was basically Scooby-Doo in that it was a group of teens solving mysteries, but instead of Scooby, they had like a shark that stood on its fins and could talk. This is nothing to do with explosives. This is like,
is it good? Should we be looking this up?
It didn't stand the test of time, is all I can say.
Well, that's disappointing. I'm just picturing like the same Scooby-Doo movie from like the early 2000s, but with a shark instead.
The shark instead. Look, and
that would be hysterical.
There is a world where that took off instead of Scooby-Doo, but we live in a Scooby-Doo world.
And is that a mistake? Time will tell.
Shark cartoon. So, what do we got? Jabberjaw. His name is Jabberjaw.
Jabberjaw.
Okay.
That, so you is can look that, up later. That is not as good as Scooby-Doo. I can see why this failed.
Right. Again, it's, oh my God, Frank Welker was in this too? What?
Who is that?
He's the guy who voiced either Fred or Shaggy, maybe both.
Oh.
I think Fred. Wild. I mean, he just did every Hanna-Barbera cartoon. That makes sense. We are so off topic from explosives.
Yeah, we've gone down a cartoon rabbit hole a little bit, but I do think there's a lot of like explosives in cartoons, so I don't think we're super off topic here.
That was the point I was trying to get at when I was pretending to get on topic, but then we went down niche Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Yeah, I think the point, and I think it's well made, is that a lot of us our first the first time I heard the word nitroglycerin was when Daffy Duck was saying it, because he was drinking it so he could become a bomb.
Right. Yeah. You hear it as a random joke in like a cartoon with like the cartoony physics of everything.
Yeah, exactly. So and the nitroglycerin was invented in 1846 by Scanio Sobrero, and it's treated glycerin. So glycerin is like, it's treated with a combination of nitric and sulfuric acid. So, I mean, obviously, if you hear the name nitroglycerin, it's all coming together. So I think what's something that's very important to note is that when you treat glycerin with nitric and sulfuric acid, that's by itself an exothermic reaction. So exothermic produces heat. And so unless nitroglycerin is actively cooled during the mixing process, it will explode.
It's just, there's no doubt in its mind there, unless you are actively combating it, these two things do not get along.
Yes.
Much like Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck.
Yes.
There and you go. Nitroglycerin
alone, yeah, it's very volatile, not safe to transport, like Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny. And it's also very susceptible to shock. And so unless the nitroglycerin is pure, the conditions for combustion are very hard to predict.
Right.
So initially it was thought this cannot possibly be industrialized. This is going to be a science thing. We probably shouldn't touch this. It's very volatile. It could explode at any time. Why would we do this to ourselves?
Why would we make this a thing we profit off of, said every reasonable person with a conscience?
Except Alfred Nobel, who was like, I can do it.
Hey, wait a minute. That name sounds familiar.
Yes, it does. We're going to loop back to him in several different ways in this episode.
Do you not want to give away the ending?
I don't. I want that to be a nice surprise at the end.
Okay.
And so Nobel was the first to produce nitroglycerin on an industrial scale. And I want to add that Nobel's lab had several accidents while trying to stabilize nitroglycerin and do reactions with nitroglycerin. And one of them killed his brother Emil in 1864.
Now, some men might mourn that loss. Most men are not Alfred Nobel, who saw an opportunity.
So 2 years before, he had made a patent for blasting oil, which is a mixture of nitroglycerin and black powder, which is a form of gunpowder. So take an incredibly volatile thing, add another explosive thing, put those together. That's blasting oil in 1862. That was closely followed by a blasting cap, which is a wood plug filled with black powder. So again, that same form of gunpowder ignited by a fuse to detonate blasting oil the next year. So he started scaling up production of blasting oil and blasting caps, and safety was obviously a huge issue. But eventually he had multiple factories. Are you ready to hear about his safety implements?
Sorry, I'm really wrapping around. His entire thesis was just these things when mixed together go boom. And instead of just studying that, trying to figure out why he immediately, what did he use this for? Like what were his stated intentions for blasting oil and blasting caps? Was it just warfare? Was he always out in the open with it?
So, I mean, there's other use, anything that you need to explode. So at this point, a lot of railroads,
bridges and stuff. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Building projects.
Okay.
So
but mostly he knew it was going to be used for war, didn't he?
I think, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Not to put words in this dead man's mouth, but.
I think he also would happily sell explosives, especially later in his life, to anybody.
Got it.
Which, you know, anyone that's going to give him enough money, which is why to this day, France is still mad at him, to my understanding.
We can just call this man a war profiteer. I can't imagine a world in which that is a controversial statement. The man profited directly from war throughout a lot of his life.
I also want to make this is important to me that you know that manufacturing was done in wooden sheds separated by earthen walls, so that if there was an accident, it wouldn't kill more than one or two people, and it was easier to rebuild the shed.
That is such a capitalist way to look at, like, oh, look, well, obviously we can afford one or two loss of lives. So, you know, because that's, you know, that just cuts into the profit so much. We have to pay the families out. But like, so we'll limit that.
Yeah.
We're not just going to stop this thing because it's clearly dangerous because this keeps happening.
Yeah.
We'll just find better ways to make sure only one or two people die. Got it. If it happens,
we'll figure out how to rebuild it cheaper.
Jesus.
He also invented one-legged stools so that people wouldn't fall asleep on the job while they were making blasting oil.
Which, you know, feels like a good idea. That's definitely not a job you want to be slacking off on.
Yeah, but also I would like a stable chair while I'm blasting oil. Just maybe.
Yes.
Like, I get the not falling asleep bit, but also at the same time, maybe shorter working hours.
Yeah, yeah, that was where I was building.
Would have been the better way to go.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I was going to get to. You cut the hours before you create a chair that will ultimately cause more problems.
Yeah. So despite the numerous safety precautions, in 1866, Nobel's factory in Germany had a huge explosion.
Oh, no.
And during the cleanup, Nobel found that the local sand mixture called Kieselguhr, which, apologize if I said that wrong to our German audience, it stabilized the nitroglycerin when mixed together in it, because it is a fine porous sand. So when you mix the nitroglycerin with that specific kind of sand, it creates a paste that can be packed and won't detonate when dropped or exposed to heat. And it requires something like a blasting cap put on the top.
Yep.
To actually detonate it. And that's dynamite.
We did it.
Patented in 1867. So dynamite is safer.
It feels like a real technical. It's like, yeah, of course, putting a bar on a go-kart is instrumentally safer than putting just letting it go free. Like, that is true. That doesn't mean people aren't still possibly going to get hurt if you do it in a dangerous, reckless way.
Right. Yeah. So you've nailed that. And so he, at this point, made an absolute fuck ton of money off dynamite and heavily industrialized its use. And when he died in 1888, the Paris press ran the headline, "The Merchant of Death is Dead." And that is a hell of a headline, and I wanted everyone to hear it.
Truly, what else is there to say? Like, that, as always, the French have a way with words, and yeah, that's who that guy was. Even if he wants to tell you it was, we used it for construction and building bridges. Like, no, you know who you're selling it to, especially near the end. Like, come on, bro.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he would sell it to truly anyone who might give him money for that. So that's kind of the caveat that I will put on Alfred Nobel.
What a man.
Yeah, so I want to wrap up the Alfred Nobel section of this episode for now. We're going to come back to him with talking about what happened after his death. So Alfred Nobel hated lawyers, and so he wrote his own will that was full of holes and really hard to execute.
He knew better than everyone, clearly.
He basically wrote a Ron Swanson-style post-it note that was like, make a charity in my name that gives scientists and doctors money. And you, my friend, Ragnar Solman, you're going to do this. Done.
And that was it. That was the whole will.
And he wanted to use over 90% of the money he had amassed through his life to create this foundation, to which his family said, oh, the fuck he will. And tied up the creation of the Nobel Foundation for 5 years after his death, contesting the sticky note. Now,
I really hope it was just like on a napkin or something, like just scrawled.
Yeah, and the executor of his will was one of Nobel's friends. Yeah. And his family was like, "Who's this guy?" And
his drinking buddy? No.
Yeah. I will say that the article I read put the friend in quotes, and I don't know what that means, but they were like, yeah, his friend, quotes. I was like, I have questions.
Could we not prove he was his friend?
It seemed like they were friends. There was like a whole subplot in the article. It's just, this is something that's been spinning in my head, I think maybe more than it should. I need an answer to this question, and I'm never going to get it. Nobel, like, bought this guy a house?
I already know where your mind is going.
Oh, yeah. and then
you didn't even have to say the house thing. It was just the way you said my mind is spinning. I was like,
the way that I read friends was, I was like,
No, I got it. Look, they were roommates, Ellie. I don't know what more you want. They lived together for years. They were best friends. They spent all their time together. They were roommates. Come on.
Yeah. And I...
Historical roommates.
Ragnar Solman was married. but that it doesn't mean much historically on the I have questions about the friends in quotes part. And Alfred Nobel was very famously a hermit who never got married, didn't have any long-term relationships. And I am not going to publicly speculate because there's not like hard evidence for this, but I have questions.
Ellie, you can just talk about your basically Our Flag Means Death version of Alfred Nobel's life. Nobody's going to keep that idea from you.
Haven't gone that far down that rabbit hole yet. Also, I'm not sure that these are the guys I want to make a rom-com about. And
No. I think these are exactly the guy, and like you lean into the fact that they're blowing shit up in every episode. I think HBO Max would go nuts for it.
Yeah, they would. Yeah, that would work.
So anyway, this guy had a long-term serious best friend.
Yes.
And we're not going to look into it any more than that.
Yes. And after he died, his friend spent the rest of his life creating the Nobel Foundation in his name and making sure that it was executed exactly the way that Alfred Nobel would have wanted it to. And that is
who in his family tied up the his parents, or
I think it just said his family. So he had like several brothers
probably.
So okay, brothers. Probably his brothers and then his brother's kids would be my guess, because there's the Nobel family is very interesting. A lot of them made their money in war and explosives.
I was weighing the ethics of like, well, you didn't make your money in war profiteering, but you're definitely willing to steal money from a foundation that is at least trying to rebrand. You're like, I don't know. On one hand, yay on maybe not letting your brother lie about his impact in history. On the other hand, like, I don't know. I don't think there are like good guys in this story.
They were just trying to take his money.
Yeah, it definitely feels like some succession type bullshit.
And I mean, if you're going to use over the vast majority, I mean, over 90% of the money he amassed throughout his life ended up in the Nobel Foundation, which gives money to people who make advancements towards peace and science. And I
felt hesitant. You have to be in like,
there are so many, like, there are so many worse uses for that money.
Right.
Like, I can't say that like what's come out of the Nobel Foundation, I think is objectively positive, but like,
yeah. It feels to me like the science equivalent of a deathbed confessional, where it's like, oh, I admit I've been doing everything wrong and that history will look back on me not kindly. So here is my like last ditch effort chance to make sure people remember me. Like, can I give it away now? I feel like we've built it up enough.
He's the Mindy St. Clair of history.
In that, I was going, but okay.
It's my Good Place reference.
Yeah, okay.
Alfred Nobel might end up in the medium place because of this.
Oh man, you caused a lifetime of pain and suffering, but fuck, damn it. Like, right at the end, you did. He literally, because that's what Mindy St. Clair was gonna do. It's like, yes. Mindy St. Clair.
It makes me wonder if this is actually a reference to that.
Wow.
No. When I read it, I was like, oh,
interesting.
Thought of the Good Place immediately.
Yeah.
This part of Alfred Nobel's story.
It's a real, I don't want to say delay. He sucked. Like, he was a bad person, but like, you kind of have to give it up for the very last thing he did being like, kind of like the fact that he specifies like giving an award to peace, considering his history. It's like the closest thing you're going to get to an admission of guilt, I think, from a man like that.
To advancement, to peace, to medicine. Like that's all good things. And I also want to note that the benefactors of the Nobel Prize get $1 million.
You're right. I don't think this is the first time we've said that. Like it's that Nobel. If we haven't made it clear, it's like, it's that Nobel Foundation, that prize.
Nobel
it's
Prize. Like, same dude. Yeah. Direct connection.
Just remember, every time you hear somebody accepts a Nobel Peace Prize, it is named after a man who you could arguably directly tied to more deaths than almost any person.
Yes. Remember, Nobel was the inventor of dynamite.
Right.
So the Nobel Peace Prize, you get $1 million in dynamite money.
Yeah. Which
I will say, if you're going to use dynamite money, using it for peace, that's pretty much the best thing you can do with it. I'm on board.
Exactly. It's like, again, therein lies the dilemma.
Well, at some point, if you're using the money for good things, it kind of doesn't matter where it comes from.
I guess. I agree, but I am also of the opinion that doesn't erase the past misdeeds. You know, it's in the same way that I think we should look at like Volkswagen, like with a little bit more of a side eye than we do.
Well, yeah. Yes.
Well, that's true of American companies too. I'm not just saying that. Yeah, like, yeah. It was like Ford too. Fuck Ford. We were awful. That was awful. Yeah. I'm from Michigan. I can say that. Ford was a giant piece of shit. Come at me, bros.
And I mean, if you look at a lot of the labor struggles that we have today.
Like, yeah, exactly. Ford all tied to him.
Some helpful things. He also really caused some problems there. So now we're going to get into the biggest explosives that we've made to date. And it's time to stop. It was time to stop a while ago. When it comes to making bigger explosions, it's time to be done.
So the last two, the previous two things we were talking about, all they were directly tied to, it was kind of like using similar chemical compounds and reactions to mix together. What happens here? What are we doing with this? Is it another like leap forward in the same sort of sphere?
So we're actually transitioning to completely different elements now. So we've been looking at the whole time with carbon-based reactions. So you've got gunpowder. Nitroglycerin is not carbon-based, but it tends to be mixed with gunpowder. So we're working with, pretty basic elements. And now we're getting into nuclear weapons, which are the biggest explosives we've ever made. And they are a combination of chemical explosives, nuclear fission, and nuclear fusion. So
easy to understand topics.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We're going to have to get into some science here about nuclear stuff in order to understand what's going on. So this is another multi-step reaction that again happens in a very small space in that it is a pressurized environment. So, or an enclosed environment that creates a chain reaction.
Right. So in that realms, it's similar to what we've been talking about.
Yes.
And, then it's another, and now it's all about to change.
Yeah. And so what happens here is you have a chemical explosive that compresses the nuclear material and causes nuclear fission. So the nuclear fission is the splitting of atoms to generate energy. So it generally involves atoms that are already unstable, like plutonium or uranium. So it's worth noting that from a chemistry perspective, when you are either splitting or putting atoms, squishing atoms, smashing atoms together to make new ones, both of those things will release some energy and require some energy. So we're first going to talk about nuclear fission, which is splitting atoms apart and putting them together takes a lot more energy, but it also produces way more.
Right.
But it requires a lot to go into that reaction. That's nuclear fusion. We're going to get there. I just wanted to let you know where we're going with this.
We're baby stepping it.
Yes. Just like the scientists did when they were making these bigger.
Well.
So nuclear fission generally involves atoms that are already unstable, like plutonium or uranium. So now we're getting into, if you're remembering from your chemistry science classes, that atoms are made up of three things: protons, neutrons, and electrons. So you have a mixture of protons, which are positively charged, and neutrons, which do not have a charge, in a dense ball in the center of the atom. And you have electrons, which are tiny, negatively charged particles spinning around this ball of positive and neutrally mixed energy. That's an atom. So when you have a single free neutron and it runs into an unstable nucleus, it will knock two or three more neutrons free.
Oh, no.
So uranium is, I want to say, element 92, which means it has 92 protons, which means that it generally there are always more neutrons than protons. I think, I am trying to remember what the isotope of uranium that they use they tend to use, I'm forgetting. There are more neutrons than protons. So you have, as soon as you have a single free neutron, it hits an unstable nucleus, it'll knock two or three of those neutrons free. And so what that leads to is you now have two or three more neutrons that are by themselves zipping around. And if you're in an enclosed space,
you have. Do you want to know the three isotopes of uranium?
Yes.
Uranium-238, the heaviest and most abundant. And then there's uranium-235 and uranium-234.
Thank you. So the way to figure out how many neutrons there are is you take the isotope number and you subtract the number of protons. So feel free to do,
if anyone wants to do that at home, since we do not. Uranium-238, uranium-235, and uranium-234. So that yourselves. We're being lazy.
This is a long way of saying that you haven't, if you are in an enclosed space, and if you, let's say you start with one neutron that hits one nucleus and knocks two or three neutrons free, you now have three or four free neutrons zipping around an enclosed space. So it's pretty easy to see why this leads to an exponential increase in free neutrons splitting atoms. So your free neutrons are knocking more neutrons off. And as more neutrons are lost, that also leads to the protons that are there. So this is a cluster of positive energy. And remember that clusters of positive or negative energy don't like to stay together, right? So it's that same charge. So eventually the atoms will degrade. They don't have enough neutrons to hold them together. So the elements themselves will also start to split and they'll lose protons as well. But what's happening is you're creating this very fast chain reaction of atoms splitting. And so that creates a lot of heat and pressure. So now you have all of this material that's basically zipping around.
Just running up against each other, bouncing everywhere, creating more and more energy as it gets more and more unstable.
Yes. So you have heat and a lot of pressure. And if you have an active fission reaction, that can be enough if you have the right elements also in place to do another step of that reaction, which is nuclear fusion.
Gotcha.
Nuclear fusion is the same concept where two, or is the opposite concept where two very small atoms are smashed together and combined. So that tends to use the smallest atoms like hydrogen and its isotopes, deuterium and tritium. And that creates a larger atom, which is the helium isotopes. So if you have hydrogen, that's one proton and one neutron. If you have H2, if you have H, you also have H3 and H4. All those have one proton, you have one, two, or three neutrons. So you're smashing those together to create something with two protons in the nucleus, which is helium. And this is how the sun produces energy. If you want an idea of how much heat,
the level we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. This is nuclear fusion is what's happening in the center of the sun.
So we are creating, and this is overstating it a little bit, but just like we're sort of creating mini suns that are just destined to explode because of the amounts of energy.
Yeah. It does create a fireball that is radioactive that will reach several tens of millions degrees, and it will be in the same range as the center of the sun.
Yeah.
During the explosion.
That sounds like a bad thing for humanity to do.
Yeah.
Like maybe ever. Like, maybe arguably one of the greatest atrocities committed if that were to have happened, let alone twice.
So it did happen twice. So two nuclear bombs have been intentionally dropped onto population dense areas. The reason that I'm saying that about this is that there have been many more nuclear bombs that have been exploded. Just not over a city. That's happened twice. Yeah. And that's in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
USA, USA, US. Nope. No one wants to join in. Not during.
Oh, not chanting USA right now.
not this weekend. Not. Come on. We got the 4th coming up.
Oh, right. This episode comes out like 2 days before the 4th.
Yeah.
Happy birthday, America.
No, this is our truly. This really is our present to you, America, a love letter to your long and torrid history, with barely directly naming you. Yay.
Oh no, America's not going to look good in the next page of this.
I mean, we've already talked about being the only people to actually use this technology, so let's really dive in.
So that is the only time that nuclear bombs have been used in warfare, and they were used on civilian populations, and I want to make that very clear.
Yep.
And it was a horrendous atrocity that killed a lot of people, not just in the initial impact, but for many, many years afterwards, because as I've stated, this isn't just a fireball, it's a radioactive fireball. Mm-hmm. And radiation causes cancer. Because when our cells are hit with radiation, that can cause mutations. We're going to talk a quick second about how, so there's a lot of things that are technically, so even like UV is a type mm-hmm. of it's a type of radiation that we get from the sun. So that's how skin cancer happens.
Like one we expose ourselves to every day, but you know, it is not necessarily going to lead to bad. Everyone's going to have a different reaction.
Yeah. So essentially what happens when we get hit with radiation is that it can lead to random mutations. So when your DNA is replicating, sometimes it makes mistakes, and that's a mutation. But what radiation does is it increases the number of mistakes. And while those mistakes are random, if those mistakes in a single cell are in the right spot, mm-hmm. it cause cancer.
Right.
More times the radiation happens, the higher likelihood you have of hitting that sweet spot and getting cancer. That's so gross oversimplification of the carcinogenesis, but that's where we're going.
Yeah, so if you were in a nearby city, or you know, not in Nagasaki or Hiroshima, but you know, in one of the many, many nearby villages, you're still going to be getting these effects just from the radioactive blowback happening from the bombs being dropped.
Yes. And after that happened, so we now have two nuclear bomb explosions, 1945. Between 1945 and 2017, over 2,000 nuclear test explosions have occurred, and there have been tests conducted by at least 8 nations, the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, China, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. That's the list.
When you have a good understanding of world history, it's really clear why, like, those are the people who have done it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I used to not really understand India and Pakistan, but I understand it better now. And that's all I'll say. I'll leave it at that.
I do not feel qualified to discuss that.
No, that's a whole thing. That's, I'm by no means an expert, but that's like, I get it a little more now. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. And most of those nuclear tests did happen underground. Mm. And I want to add that underground testing still will often vent into the atmosphere, and it definitely is radioactive contamination in the soil. However, sure, before
that's not bad at all.
Before 1963, they were just exploding nuclear bombs just on the surface.
Well, there's a bunch of great pictures back in, like, you know, Americans gathering around Miss like nuclear pageants and stuff like that, where they were just like, watch these bombs going off, like slowly killing themselves, not knowing.
Yeah, because the radiation goes much further than the bomb.
Yeah.
And so that testing has caused extensive harm to human health and the environment. And that many testing sites, even those that have been partially cleaned up, they remain completely uninhabitable. And I don't have like a count on the loss of human life from nuclear explosions. Even if we stopped all nuclear testing, and we have stopped pretty much all nuclear testing, there are still lingering effects from that radiation today.
Mm. You're never going to really know like the damage if we are ever able to do a big cleanup and do a full cleanse. And that doesn't seem to be our priorities at the moment.
And And that's if we're able to count, right? Because there's a lot of, there are so many people that will pass away from cancer, or there's also a lot of evidence that suggests particular strontium 90 causes a large increase in birth defects and has like disproportionate health effects for people who get pregnant. So I want to talk specifically about Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands for a little while. So after World War II, the residents of Bikini Atoll were forcibly relocated in 1946. And the United States performed 23 nuclear tests there until 1958. And in 1954, there was a test there that was so big that it blanketed nearby islands with radioactive ash as well. And that island remains uninhabitable due to the very high levels of strontium 90 and caesium 137 that were discovered in residence when they tried to move back in the 1970s.
Seems like a real screw up on our part there.
Yeah. And I want to add that everyone on that island was displaced and they have not been able to return.
That's just the tale of America.
Yeah. I don't have a joke for that. That's just something that made me very angry and sad. And I think it's important that people know about it.
Can I pull us out with a fun fact that might intrigue you?
Sure.
Bikini Atoll is the inspiration for Bikini Bottom from SpongeBob.
Nice.
Because like there's a lot of rumors and fan theories that it's like they picked the nuclear testing spot specifically to explain why all the fish and wacky hijinks are there, why everything explodes when you touch it. So you know, the one good-ish thing to come from all this, if you like SpongeBob, there you go.
There you go. So I do want to add that during this, there were like active nuclear, like anti-nuclear protests during all of this testing. Like there were people protesting saying, hey, we shouldn't be doing this kind of testing. It's very dangerous, talking about these effects at the time. And those concerns built, particularly over the effects of strontium 90 due to, like I said, the disproportionate effects on pregnant people. And in 1963, the Limited Test Treaty was passed, which outlawed atmospheric, underwater, and space nuclear testing. But very importantly, it did not get rid of underground testing.
Right. So that's when they all moved down below.
Well, United States, Russia, and the United Kingdom signed the treaty, but France and China did not and went on to conduct atmospheric nuclear tests after 1963. In 1996, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was adopted by the international community, and that put a moratorium on all nuclear testing, with the exception of North Korea, who have continued to do nuclear testing to this day, but they're the only
one. Yeah, they're just going to do what they want. They're going to do what they want.
As far as I know, that's in 1996, they stopped, with the exception of North Korea. As far as we know, I don't
officially
have been nuclear tests up until this point that I could find.
The record that we are willing to talk about.
Yeah,
that is the last of them.
Yes. And I think I want to really hammer this home is that nuclear testing didn't occur in actually isolated places. In a lot of cases, people lived there or they used to live there or they lived nearby. Particularly, nuclear testing occurred close to and without warning to many indigenous communities, including those in the Marshall Islands and in Australia. I want to particularly highlight those two, although they are not the only ones in the.
It happened everywhere. We'll highlight those specific places, but you know we want to acknowledge that like this was just it was a bad thing, and we just kept doing it everywhere. There was like free, quote unquote, free land.
And when governments say free land, that does not mean that people don't live there.
Exactly.
And that racism played a significant factor in how those sites were chosen.
Oh yeah.
So I want to end this on something that is not just horrible. So I want to talk about the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN. So they worked, they have worked hard for years and years and years to create a treaty that was adopted in 2017, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It's been adopted by 122 states, including 63 countries to date when this podcast is recorded. And it seeks the total abolition of all nuclear weapons, as well as international cooperation to produce funds to help victims of nuclear testing and rehabilitation and cleanup of nuclear test sites to make them habitable again.
Basically, it's Superman 4. If you've seen Superman 4 with Nuclear Man, it's this is for the audience who's seen Superman 4. It's did you know Superman threw all of Earth's nukes into the sun in the movies once?
Huh.
You would either like this movie or hate it because it's a good concept done pretty badly.
Perfect. Sounds like the Star Wars prequels, which I like very much. So
I can't remember if this is the one with Richard Pryor in it or not. That might be 3. I think 3 is Richard Pryor, 2 has John Cryer, fresh off of Pretty in Pink.
Huh.
It's a weird movie.
Yeah. I did want to, with the Treaty of Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, give a shout out to Mexico. We're going to talk a little bit about where North America is at with this treaty. New Mexico was the 4th state to ratify with unanimous appeal by their Senate in 2017.
Go Mexico.
Yeah, so go Mexico. Big shout out to Mexico. Canada and the United States have yet to adopt the treaty. So
well,
calling out to you two. So obviously the United States has one of the biggest stashes of nuclear weapons in the world. Canada does not have nuclear weapons, but they continue.
It makes it even weirder they won't sign the treaty.
Well, they're supporting the United States in their having nuclear weapons.
Well, yell at us more, Canada. We're fucking up on this.
Yep. So that's where North America is at. And I can receive the Nobel Peace Prize. For this treaty, wrapping things back to Alfred Nobel. The Peace Prize, although ICANN is a large organization of people, the Nobel Peace Prize was accepted with speeches by Beatrice Finn and Setsuko Thurlow, who was a Hiroshima survivor and spent her entire life has spent her entire life working on the abolishment of nuclear weapons. So go her.
Wow, we somehow managed to tie in basically all 3 points right in that last minute.
Yep. And I would recommend going to look up their speeches. They're very good. So we're gonna end the episode in explosives by talking about a Nobel Peace Prize, because that's about the...
Even the man who caused a lot of this still ends up getting some credit at the end.
Because in this case, I think... The ICANN are a group of people that could use $1 million, no matter where it's from,
yeah,
to do this kind of work. So I'm happy that ICANN got $1 million. As far as I'm aware, they seem like they're pretty good people doing pretty good things.
You have yet to cancel ICANN, so we'll keep them in our good graces for now.
And that's, I would say, honestly, that is the point I wanted to end on in this episode, is that it is there's a lot of bad and sad in this episode, but I also, there are people that are working really hard to get rid of nuclear weapons, and that they are trying to make the world better. And I commend that.
They're even being helped by some of the same people who got us in this mess. So, you know, it's a real kind of mixed bag on that. You can't always choose the people helping you out.
But I mean, $1 million is $1 million. So
exactly. No, I mean, God, we're starting to sound like the DNC. Well, of course, I'm going to help out this like nice big guy who usually votes Republican, because he gave me $1 million.
Oh, Nick, I was trying to end things on a happy note here.
no, we're going to cheer and we're going to support the Nobel Foundation. We love the Nobel Foundation. They only do good.
Yep.
Do not look up on their history. Ignore everything else you just heard in this podcast.
The Nobel Foundation has a mixed bag of awards. I think we've talked about several Nobel laureates on this podcast.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
Because it's most of the awards are science awards. So a lot of the
science or peace, yeah.
I do think this is our first Nobel Peace Prize mention, so that's exciting. But I mean,
maybe we'll get literature next.
Yeah, we can look into that.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, we covered it all. I think we're ending on as happy of a note as we can.
I didn't want to leave it too sad at the end of season two here. Because this is the end of season two, Nick. We did it.
We made it through. We're going on another little pause for a bit.
Yeah.
Other than, you know, the earlier pause that we put on ourselves, but
but that was a little one. This is going to be a longer one.
This is a long pause.
Yeah. We'll be picking new topics to bring to y'all.
Changing up the format a little bit based on maybe some of our discussions if we go through with some of those plans.
Yeah, we have new plans for season three.
I won't name it to not give it away. I know you listened to the podcast about a subject we've talked about. Have you watched the show?
Nope.
Do you want to watch the show, or do we want to approach it from the different perspectives? Let's give them a little behind the scenes.
That might be fun. I think we're gonna try to change up some topics for season three, and I have some fun ideas already. So does Nick. I think it'll be a lot of fun, but we are going to take a longer hiatus so that we can actually take the time to write up the season and get it really ready to go before we start releasing things.
Yeah.
Before
we both get busy again.
Yeah. But we'll try to post some bonus episodes as well, because there's not going to be a lack of science news.
Small things. Oh yeah.
In our hiatus period. So, everybody stay safe. And I don't know what else to say. I'm just concerned in general about the world. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, good luck with everything. We hope we'll talk to you guys soon.
Yeah.
We plan to.
We plan to talk to you soon.
All right. So,
an everyday dissection.
I'm Nick Lemmer.
I'm Ellie Weissa.
Goodbye, season two.